Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith.
Good evening. I am Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio, where we can be found on Blog Talk Radio starting Mondays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time with the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mamma Mia No Sharia. Me, Hank Jones, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time with Hank Jones Poly Sports. We talk politics. We talk sports. We get after it, and sometimes I rant. Occasionally, I'll do a show on Thursdays called Hankerings. It's basically just a short show, usually single issue or something I didn't really get to on a previous show. I'm thinking I'm going to do one tomorrow because I'm paddling early, so I should be back. So if I do one, it'll probably be around 7 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow. I have a couple things that I didn't really cover that I sort of want to cover that I'm not covering on this show. So probably will do that at 7 o'clock tomorrow. And, of course, Saturday night, 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. So, all that said, several ways you can listen to a show on here. You can come in to blogtalkradio.com, look for the live button up on the left, click it. And as you get in there, go down to the bottom right and look for shows that have chatters, and you'll see Global Patriot Radio. You can also get a free account, log in, come into the chat room, as Duck Northwest Media has done. Duck is in the chat room. He's looking for people to talk to, so come on in. You can do that. You can interact. You can ask questions, and hosts will try and stay abreast of what's happening in the conversation, and where appropriate, we'll filter it into our subject matter. You can also call in. You can listen by calling 319-527-6706. The good thing there, while you're in listening, if you have something to say, the one, and we get a little hand raise that says somebody wants to talk. Now, if you've never called the show, what I would ask you to do is get into the chat and just say, making a phone call, this is my area code. Don't need to know the number, just need to know the area code. And the reason for that is that at least we know that somebody's making a legit call. Now, if you try to get funny, if you try to like swear or say something cute, that's that, you know, first of all, if you're having to get on the internet to swear, you're a moron. It's already allowed. Nobody cares. It's like being on Howard Stern on Sirius XM radio. Nobody cares. I mean, great, you can swear. Big deal. But if you have something to say that's germane to what we're talking about, we certainly, you know, we're going to entertain it. What I will not entertain is far left fringe crap. I won't abide personal attacks, I guess you'd say, on people, even on college athletes, even though they're paid now. I wouldn't abide a personal attack on someone. I will certainly abide somebody that says he doesn't move well without the ball, or he can't hit to save his life, or he can't hit to the opposite field, or my gosh, he pulls every field goal attempt wide, or pulls it left, whatever. I mean, I'll talk about that. But if you're going to make it a personal attack on somebody, no, I really don't. Politicians, fair game. Business leaders, fair game. Celebrities, fair game. But, you know, high school players, college players, even pro players, if you want to talk about, you know, I'll talk about Colin Kaepernick and his kneeling and all that, but I mean, Colin Kaepernick's not in the league, not because he can't play football. He can, but he's not a starter because he's just not good enough to be a starter. It's simple as that. Welcome Holger to the chat room. He is hanging out here today. I know why he's hanging out here. He's going to get into probably the Iowa-Minnesota results. And we'll talk about that a little bit. No two ways about it. We're going to have to. With his Goldie Gopher sweatshirt. He'll pay for that, folks. He'll pay for that. As I said, I don't really have much in the way of internet laughing. While this stuff is going on in Gaza and in Israel, I'm just not going to do too much. I have some, and I'll put them in there when they're worth it. But for the most part, I'm just not going to do that right now. And as I said, as I go through obituaries, I'm not going to, as long as the people where I look up obituaries online, I look at various places, but as long as they acknowledge the deaths of Hamas or people from quote unquote, the Palestinian Authority or whatever, there is no Palestine. I'm not going to argue that. Don't call up and tell me there is. I'm not going to argue that there are Palestinians because there's no such thing. But as long as they're going to acknowledge the people on both sides, no. I would acknowledge people from Israel, but they list others, so I can't. I'm not going to do that then. I just won't. Sorry. Last week's losses that I deem significant. Last Wednesday, we lost singer-songwriter Dwight Twilley at age 72. No cause was listed. He was alternately labeled as power, pop, and rockabilly. He had some moderate, I'd say very moderate success with the songs Girls and I'm on Fire. I'll tell you what, when you run down his list of singles, you might guess one reason for his limited success is that so many of his songs share titles with actual successful songs. You'd be right if you said that. That said, he did have a fan following. He did record and work with, you know, the likes of Tom Petty and Leon Russell, so it's certainly a loss to the music world, but, you know, we haven't lost, like, the next Hendrix or anything like that, but it's a sad loss. Only 72. Thursday the 19th was a red letter day in terms of obit. We lost former Austrian Olympic champion Ilse Steininger at the age of 98. We lost former Russian biathlete and cross-country skier and three-time Olympic champion Anfisa Retzova to cardiac arrest at age 58. She was only 58. Former Austrian bronze medal skier Heinrich Messner was 84. Former actress and author and also one of Grace Kelly's bridesmaids, Judy Balaban, at age 91, and hip-hop record producer and DJ Mark Howard James, a.k.a. The 45 King, at age 62. He produced early stuff for Queen Latifah. He also produced It's a Hard Knock Life, sampled from the musical Annie. It was a mega hit for Jay-Z. Friday, we lost former Marine Corps Colonel and Nixon political aide Jack Brennan at age 86. He served in Vietnam, earned a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart at the Battle of Khe Sanh. He was appointed as a Marine Corps aide in 1969. He accompanied Nixon on his visits to China, the Soviet Union, and the Vatican. Later served as Nixon's chief of staff after Nixon resigned the presidency. He was pivotal in getting Nixon to open up for his interview with David Frost, while at the same time stressing to David Frost that making it a hatchet piece on Nixon might satisfy the political bloodthirsty types, but would not serve the American people. Saturday, the 21st, we lost Samantha Wohl, president of Detroit's Isaac Agri Synagogue. She was stabbed to death. She was just 40. She was crucial, actually, in helping to calm tensions between Jewish and Muslim students in the Detroit area by way of a public essay and art contest that they held at Wayne State University. Now, police have not confirmed any anti-Semitic motives in the killing, but let's just say, this is me interjecting personally here, let's just say it's probably not a coincidence that her murder occurred as things heat up between Israel and the evil axis of Hamas, Hezbollah, and their chief sponsor, Iran. We also lost English Hall of Fame star soccer player Sir David Charlton at age 86. He played on the winning World Cup team in 1966, England's only World Cup champion. He also survived the 1958 Munich air disaster. It was a British European Airways jet that crashed, claimed 23 lives among Manchester United club and staff and journalists. And then finally, we also lost Bobby, a Portuguese dog that was confirmed to be the oldest dog ever, died at the age of 31. He was the first dog confirmed to have reached the age of 30. Sunday, we lost American casino entrepreneur Don Laughlin at age 92. Yes, the town of Laughlin, Nevada is named for him. He established a hotel casino there along the Colorado River, which is near the junction of Nevada, Arizona, and California, just off Route 66. Called the Riverside Resort and Casino. It is still there to this day. Part of the appeal early on was the 98-cent chicken dinners that they served for years. But Laughlin became a player in Nevada, the town of Laughlin, the area, the resorts and casinos. It's still no Vegas, but it has it is a place to visit, no doubt. Monday, we lost British thoroughbred racehorse Desert Crown. Desert Crown won the 2021 Dante's Derby. Just 4 years old, Desert Crown was euthanized after being able to unable to recover from a fractured leg back in August. Wow, this one's tough. Yesterday, we lost Richard Roundtree, who, with his role of John Shaft, easily makes the list of coolest actors of the 1970s. He succumbed to pancreatic cancer yesterday. Just 81 years old. Let's just enjoy this 4+ minutes of cool. Let's just do it. I'm doing it. I've always wanted to play this on the show, so we're digging it. This is the theme from Shaft. Got to give props to Isaac Hayes, who was the musical mastermind who helped bring Shaft to life with this soundtrack. Instrumentation is fabulous. The lyrics were iconic, and Isaac Hayes himself became sort of an icon of cool at that time. Part of the formidable talent of Stax Records in the 60s and 70s. That was the brilliantly written, brilliantly performed theme from Shaft by Isaac Hayes. It started the movie Shaft, which featured Richard Roundtree, who passed away yesterday at the age of 81. He appeared in the Shaft sequels. He appeared in several TV series. He appeared in the miniseries Roots, which, although it was later maligned because Alex Haley might have, let's just say, taken some liberties in writing the story, it was still a brilliantly written story and a brilliantly done TV series. I mean, anytime it does come on, I still watch it. I get into those family sagas and historical sagas. I watch it like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You're thinking, Hank, what are you doing watching the Hatfields and the McCoys? But when that came on as a miniseries, one with, I don't remember who was in it. I think it might have been Costner. I watched it. I watched it all the way through. I love those things. Don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center for messaging and answering services for your medical clinic, service company, law office, information gathering services. They run the gamut. If you're one of those companies that decided not to reopen your office after COVID, you figure we don't need the office, they can be a key part of that transition. They can be your front line. Take your incoming calls, take messages, or if necessary, distribute them, dispatch them, however you need it done. They work with remote staff as well. So things like hurricanes, tornadoes, snowstorms, and it might affect a localized area, but they have staff all over, so they can always be up and running. If you'd like that kind of work, we work remotely, don't have to go to an office, give them a call. If you're one of those companies that needs their services, absolutely. 800-555-3738, or check them out on the web at communications.com. Before I continue, folks, I have a prayer, I guess a request, really. Anybody that's listened to my show for a while, back in 2020, I had a woman on named Felicia Goodson. She is the mother of former Hawkeye Tyler Goodson. And she came on the show in July of 2020. She came on at the time. University of Iowa was going through some allegations of racism, and she came on for several reasons. One, she was starting up a nonprofit called the Minority Athlete Coalition, and it was not to be a union against colleges. It was to it served several purposes. It was to help universities adjust and deal with and be able to interact better with athletes that were coming in from different racial backgrounds. As she said at the time, she said she didn't know it was a problem, but she said if it's a problem, it's not an Iowa problem. It's a college problem. That schools needed to be able to deal better with it, coaching staffs. That players themselves had to be able to deal with certain things. That they weren't, you know, that they're stars in high school, but they get to college, and guess what? They're just another person on the team. So, you know, there's things like homesickness, all those kinds of factors. And she wanted to help schools and athletes together by reaching out to both. So she came on the show, and she said several things at the time. She said, number one, they were shocked. They didn't know anything of this was going on. Well, they reached out to Tyler, and Tyler didn't know any of it was going on. Said of Chris Doyle, who was the strength and conditioning coach, said, it absolutely shocked him. He said, he's my dude. He attributed much of his development, physical development, to Chris Doyle. She also said at the time, she said, Kirk Ferentz isn't a racist. She says, I've known racists. I've grown up with racists. Kirk Ferentz isn't a racist. She says, she's right. She says, you know. And so it's one of my favorite shows still that I've ever done. I've stayed in touch with her a bit on Twitter. Haven't been as much in touch since Tyler's been gone from the university, but anytime I see her, I always, you know, interact whenever I can. In fact, Tyler's final season, which was his junior year, but my wife and I were on our way to Georgia for our 25th anniversary, and they live in Georgia, the Goodsons. And so I just happened to mention that I was where I was going to be, and she's, oh, they were going to see their son or another son perform in a production up where he went to school. and so they were going to watch him. She goes, otherwise, we'd have gone down there and joined you for it. I mean, she's just genuinely sweet person. And I'll tell you something else. Tyrone Tracy, I've talked about him, transferred from Iowa to Purdue. When he said one time, when I was talking about Tyler Goodson, he said, you know, he just comes from a great family. You know, you just can see it. You just know it. And you know, he just spoke highly of him and his family. And Tyrone himself is a pretty stellar kid. So anyway, Felicia is undergoing a health challenge. She tweeted out, I don't remember if it was today, if I saw it today, could have been yesterday, but I just saw it today. She said, you know, basically that, you know, she's going through cancer treatment and I think it right now going through radiation. And so it didn't say anything about a prognosis or anything, just said she's fighting the fight. And as I said, it took me by surprise. She's young. I would imagine she's younger than me, even though, I mean, her son is, you know, her oldest son is a decade or more younger than my daughter. So I would imagine she's quite a bit younger than me, if not, well, you know, however. But the point being, it was a shock, and she's such a good person. I don't want to say she doesn't deserve this. Nobody deserves it. But if we could extend prayers for her, just if you're a praying person, and if you're not, maybe you should start. Just say one for Felicia Goodson and her family. Her husband, Maurice, has always been a, you know, a Hawkeye supporter and interacted with fans on Twitter and elsewhere. And the Hawkeye family, you know, the college football teams are a family to some extent. And so, you know, I know others are reaching out and praying for, but just pray for her. Pray for her, for husband and for her sons, just so that they, you know, maybe lift a little bit of the anxiety that a family goes through with something like this. You know, we can say, heal her, please, God, and we want that. But we also know God's will be done. We don't know what God's will is. We just, you know, we can discern certain things. But in this case, pray for the family. Pray for discernment. Pray for comfort. You know, it's one thing to pray for health and her and all, but it would be just as much to pray for their comfort and their ease of anxiety, and to keep them God and help them to feel supported and loved. So please pray for Felicia Goodson. Great gal. Like I said, one of the funnest shows I've ever done. Really just, it was a fun show to do. She was just so easy to talk to and work with in doing it. I didn't do a lot of prep beforehand. I just sort of reached out to her, and she was more than willing to come on. And, you know, it's just, it's ironic that these things happen. You know, it's, you know, people say, like Christopher Reeve said after his accident, why not me? But still, I get this sense it's just not fair. So please pray for Felicia Goodson. Please pray for her family. And thank you in advance for indulging me there. So let's get to our stuff. So the GOP evidently tanked Jim Jordan's efforts to become speaker. A handful of Republicans had reached out to Democrats, apparently to tank Jordan's speaker bid. Mike Rogers of Alabama was one of them. He did not want him to replace McCarthy. Now, Steve Scalise was originally chosen. He opted to withdraw his name because he knew he didn't have the votes. Jordan did not get the votes because he had enough people in the Republican Party that didn't support him. He said there was Mike Rogers said there was nothing he could do, that Jordan could do to get his support. Supposedly Rogers lunged after Matt Gaetz during initial speaker votes this past January. Of course, Hakeem Jeffries, the Democrat House leader, was thrown into the fray. So Rogers was one of them. Ann Wagner of Missouri, Don Bacon of Nebraska, Mario Diaz-Balart of Florida, they all said they would not vote for Jordan. King of New York, retired Republican representative, said Jordan was too close to Trump. You know, I mean, what is it? You know, he's nominated by the party and they don't support him. Anna Paulina Luna called for additional votes, wanted transparency. They kept doing these things in secret ballot. You know, and Anna Paulina Luna was one that said, this is crazy. Why isn't the public seeing this? Why aren't we showing the public how this is going? So that was one. Additionally, John Rutherford, another representative that opposed Jim Jordan, says, I oppose him because of character flaws and to teach him a lesson. After voting against Jordan for the third time, he appeared on the Mark Kay Show. And some of what he said, I mean, first of all, he pivoted. He double-talked. He says Scalise won the majority vote. The minority should have gone with him. And Jim Jordan, he should have led that minority. He got beat by Steve Scalise. That's how it's supposed to work. But now after you know what we saw those eight do, there's this idea that somehow the minority is going to get to dictate to the majority. That's not the way this works. Yeah, so then why didn't he support him? It was pointed out by Mark Kay. You know, Jordan won his nomination with a majority. In fact, a bigger majority than Scalise. He says, no, this is about accountability. Jim Jordan lost the election. I'm not going to reward him by making him speaker. Now, this is about accountability. Well, Scalise withdrew. Jordan got the nomination. And he didn't support it. The host then said, so you're not going to go with the majority, even though the rule, as you say, is to go with the majority? He says, I went with the majority. Because Jim Jordan's the one that refused to go to the majority, and I can't abide by that. Well, Steve Scalise withdrew. He says, I'm not going to tolerate that and reward bad behavior. Jordan publicly endorsed Scalise, by the way, pledged to vote for him on the floor. Jordan offered to give Scalise's nomination. But it was Scalise, according to the speaker, the show host, Mark Kay, that failed the Rutherford test because he didn't get behind the majority of the conference's decision. They say Scalise worked behind the scenes to undermine Jordan's path to the speakership. More on the speaker crap later, of course, but just unbelievable, all of that. There's a squad member who wants to accept Palestinian refugees, and as I've pointed out, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. There's just not. So Jamal Bowman, you know, the guy that pulled the fire alarm because he thought he was, wants the U.S. to accept refugees displaced by the widely expected Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip. He's under investigation still for pulling the fire alarm, by the way. He suggests the U.S. is obligated to accept refugees escaping the violence. An estimated 1 million people have already been displaced. He says 50% of the population in Gaza are children. The international community, as well as the United States, should be prepared to welcome refugees from Palestine while being very careful to vet and not allow members of Hamas. Are you kidding me? Approximately 57 people who live in the Gaza Strip maintain an opinion of Hamas that is at least somewhat positive, according to the Washington Institute. Yeah, he's one of those that he called for an end to the blockade. He called for a ceasefire like the rest of the squad. Several Republican senators made clear they will not support any attempts to resettle Palestinians. Marco Rubio said the U.S. is the most generous nation in the world, but we are in no position to accept additional refugees, especially from a region with as high a risk of terrorism, given our nation's inability to secure our own border or vet those who are already here. Guess who's refused? No, Egypt participates in the blockade of the Gaza Strip. They have refused to accept any refugees fleeing the war. No other Arab country is willing to accept them either, according to Reuters. Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, said that it should be Iran that takes responsibility for any refugees caused by its proxy war with Israel. You believe that? That there's actually somebody in our government who says we should accept refugees from Gaza? Bob Menendez has got new charges pending, or not pending, he's been charged with nothing. You know, he's indicted on charges of bribery now, taking money from foreign entities in exchange for special treatment. That's what he was charged with initially. Both he and his wife are accused. But now federal prosecutors are increasing the charges. He's not only being accused of accepting bribes, but working for a foreign government, conspiring for years to act as an agent of the Egyptian government while he held a powerful role in shaping U.S. foreign policy, putting the Democrat in deeper legal trouble. He continues to reject calls from his own party to resign. DOJ, he worked on behalf of another government. He's maintained his innocence despite finding gold bars, cash, says he's running for re-election. John Fetterman called on the full Senate to vote on a resolution to expel Bob Menendez. John Fetterman. I think we have that. That tape. We got transcript of Fetterman talking. Yeah, here it is. Fetterman talking about the getting rid of or expelling Bob Menendez. Here it is. That was John Fetterman talking about Bob Menendez being expelled from that he should be expelled from the Senate. Well, here's what I don't understand. Fetterman says he should have been gone long ago, citing his previous indictment, which resulted in a mistrial. Fetterman said it's not even a close call. I don't know how they understood him saying that, because as we know, he talks like Charlie Brown's teacher. Now, they've done something. His voice sounds better now, but I don't know if it's being did or what. You know, if they remove him, it might help Democrats get a candidate sooner, because they're desperate to hold on to the majority, the Democrats are. Over half of Senate Democrats have urged him to resign, but it says it's unclear whether they will join Republicans to vote him out. It's likely most Senate Republicans will be on board with removing him. You know, here's the thing. It always happens this way. If this was a Republican, he would have been gone yesterday or a week ago. But the Democrats, it's literally, yeah, Holder, it's Charlie Brown's teacher. Didn't you know? Fetterman supposedly, when people talk to him, that's what he hears. He hears Charlie Brown's teacher, and I don't know why he's still in the Senate. That's another good question. But if this were a Republican, he'd have been out by now. He or she would have been out. You know, with the death of Samantha Wall, Holger made a point. Have they checked where Rashida Tlaib was? Now, like I said, my answer to that was I would not be at all surprised. I would not be shocked if some of the squad was peripherally connected. I don't doubt that they were directly, but it would not shock me down the road to hear that at all. At all. But seriously, Bob Menendez are not even – I mean, how – it's amazing how quickly they pulled a second impeachment on President Trump, record time. But here's a guy this is the second time he's been accused of corruption. Unbelievable. There's some weird behavior from MSDNC. Apparently, they are sidelining some of their anchors who are typically anti-Israel, pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas, whatever you want to call it. Apparently some of made comments that some view as insensitive and inappropriate in response to the Hamas's attacks. They did not air a recent edition of the Mehdi Hasan show on their streaming platform. They reversed plans to have Ayman Moyeldin fill in for Joy Reid. And evidently Alicia Mendez, no connection to Bob and Nadine, was replacing Ali Velshi. And Hassan, this is Mehdi Hasan, shared a post condemning future Israeli war crimes on Twitter in the hours after the Hamas attacks. He called the, Moyeldin called it the deadly consequence of failed policies. Velshi said, there's no nuance or recognition of anything that has been going on. Unbelievable. Yeah, they're getting bounced. Now, apparently some MS DNC employees are concerned with the moves. They say most of them are, quote unquote, highly skeptical of Israeli use of force while appearing to be sympathetic to the Palestinian side. Stop with the Palestinian crap. Hamas raped numerous women, murdered Israeli soldiers and civilians, raped numerous women, abducted scores of people. Now, they have released at least two hostages who've said they were treated well. But as somebody else pointed out, one of them, her husband is still being held. She's not about to do stupid stuff. Typical big left, some calling it Israeli apartheid regime. Unbelievable. NBC, which owns MSDNC, said the changes are coincidental. Reportedly say no, none of them have been sidelined. So who knows? But MSDNC, thus far, tending to not break out the full onslaught of anti-Semitism yet. I mean, it's a matter of time. But okay, so we always talk about, oh, they'll never take away the Second Amendment. Maybe not in its entirety, but places will do it in bits and pieces. Beginning September 13th, New York State gun retailers have modified their procedure for conducting background checks, the new law signed by Governor Kathy Hochul. Instead of connecting directly with FBI National Instant Criminal Background Check for ammunition background checks, they will now coordinate with New York State Police. The state police will then liaise with NICS to process the checks. Yeah, so a sale can only finalize once a proceed status is issued by the state's NICS unit. During a firearm background check, individuals can still be declined in the ammunition background assessment with a 30-day appeal window granted for failed checks. It's a $9 fee for firearms checks and a $2.50 fee for ammunition checks, which is aimed at supporting the state's NICS unit and the background check infrastructure. However, local gun store operators are apprehensive about navigating the intricacies of the revamped law, fearing potential complications arising from the increased number of involved steps. Yeah. Believe it or not, New York State is now requiring background checks on purchases of ammunition. Background checks for purposes of purchasing ammunition. It's just an end around, an end run it's just, people have to be able to protect themselves, especially now. I'm going to read something I got from somebody. I'm not going to use names. Text message I received yesterday. So it's in regard to, you know, we've been told about increased vigilance as the stuff heats up between Israel and the thugs in Gaza. So this is from someone whose brother works for TSA security at an airport. He just texted. He said, "We're getting some nonspecific but scary intel updates. Be careful where you go, even at places like the grocery store. There are warnings out about small group attacks as opposed to lone wolf stuff. Get yourself a 9mm. Now, personally, that's not my gun of choice, but that's not the point. The point is it's a very prominent gun, prevalent gun, ubiquitous gun, I guess you'd say. And this is real, folks. We are going to have attacks here. If the more the U.S. gets involved, the more attacks we will have here. You know, we did a fantastic job for the most part after 9/11. The first person that served after President Bush, I know people did the Patriot Act and all that. Measures had to be taken. Like it or not, measures had to be taken. Now, some people say, well, you sacrificed liberty. We didn't sacrifice liberty. We increased vigilance. I'm a Second Amendment supporter all the way. Now, I'm not a vigilante supporter. I'm not one that is for government spying on everybody. But if there's cause, then absolutely. But again, what happens is, you know, when government can break the law in an emergency, government creates emergencies in order to be able to break laws. I get all that. But we did a pretty good job after 9/11, being sure that we were safe and making sure that Americans remained vigilant. And then in a space of 8 years, we had a president, Barack Hussein Obama, who blamed anti-Islamic rhetoric that often usually did not exist, for terror attacks. I mean, there would be terror attacks, and first of all, they would call things like terror attack at a workplace violence, like Fort Hood. They call that workplace violence. San Bernardino, I believe, as well. The Pulse, you know, they couched it as anti-gay, you know, anti-LGBT. They didn't want to point out the fact that it was also Puerto Rican night there, or Latin night. Because the Latin community down south of Orlando coexists near a Muslim camp training center, if you will. It's not called a training center, but everyone who understands knows that's damn well what it is. But, yeah, we went from being vigilant to 8 years of it's our fault. President Trump, again, reversed that trend, and now, again, we don't even know how many illegal, undocumented, whatever, are here. We do know that many people on terrorist watch lists have gotten through our southern border. So, yeah, be armed. You know, know how to use it. Don't just buy a gun if you don't know how to use it or if you're afraid of it. Learn how to use it. But, yeah, if you're inclined to buy a gun, absolutely do it. Okay, this next story kind of sucks because I just flew this airline. So I flew Alaska Airlines out to Vancouver for our cruise to Alaska. So an off-duty pilot allegedly tried to take down a plane in mid-flight, and nobody knows why. For 2 decades, Joseph Emerson had a successful career as an airline pilot. He joined Alaska Air in 2001 as a first officer before becoming a pilot in 2019. On Sunday, and I'm not sure exactly if it was this, I'm pretty sure it was this past Sunday. On Sunday, he was involved in an incident that shocked people who know him to the core. While traveling in the flight deck jump seat in the cockpit of a plane flying from Seattle to San Francisco, he allegedly attempted to cut off fuel to the engines. He was subdued by the flight crew, arrested, and hit with 167 charges, including 83 counts of first-degree attempted murder. He now also faces a federal charge of interfering with flight crew members and attendants. No one was hurt, authorities said, but the FBI is working with the Port of Portland police to investigate the incident. Many questions remain unanswered as to what led Mr. Emerson to allegedly attempt to crash the plane mid-flight. Here's what we know so far. What happened on the flight? Authorities said Mr. Emerson, who was off duty at the time, was traveling in the flight deck jump seat in the cockpit when he suddenly tried to shut down both of the plane's engines by pulling the fire extinguisher handles. He was then subdued by flight crew as the captain and first officer intervened to keep the engines running. He was escorted by a flight attendant to the rear of the aircraft where he was placed in wrist restraints and belted into the aft jump seat. According to Alaska Airlines, he also attempted to grab the handle of the emergency exit during the aircraft's descent before being stopped by a flight attendant. The flight, traveling from Seattle to San Francisco, was diverted to Portland, and all 80 passengers on board were able to board a new plane. Passengers who are on board the plane told ABC News that they were not immediately alerted to what Alaska Airlines called a security threat until a flight attendant told them over the speaker that there was an emergency situation and the plane needed to land immediately. Once landed, the police boarded the aircraft, arrested him, escorted him off the plane handcuffed. One of the passengers on the plane told Laura Coates Live, I guess that's a talk show or radio show or TV show, that the suspect was calm and cooperative as he was escorted off the plane. Following the incident, Mr. Emerson was immediately removed from service indefinitely and relieved from all duties at Alaska Airlines, thank God. The airline said it's now consulting with its partners in labor regarding his employment status. Who is he? He was taken into custody with 167 charges, including the 83 attempted murder, 83 counts of reckless endangerment, and one count of endangering an aircraft. His alleged motive remains unclear. Prior to the incident, he was a pilot with Alaska Airlines. According to the airline, he joined as a Horizon first officer in August 2001. In 2012, he left Horizon to join Virgin America as a pilot, but became an Alaska Airlines first officer following their acquisition of Virgin America in 2016. He became a captain in 2019. Neighbors said that the 44-year-old lives with his wife and two young sons in California. He was described as friendly and a fantastic father. He plays with the kids all the time. He's just a great guy, very understanding of other people. We just couldn't imagine him doing anything to hurt someone. It's very hard for us to believe that he would do anything intentionally like that. I can't fathom him doing anything that would hurt anyone. That was one neighbor. Her husband described the incident as very shocking. He seems like a really nice guy. Nothing abnormal about him, the guy told CNN. It is not known why he attempted to crash the plane, though he reportedly told police following arrest that he had a nervous breakdown and had been taking psychedelic mushrooms. According to a federal affidavit seen by The Independent, he told police he was experiencing a nervous breakdown and not slept in 40 hours. He explained to officers, I didn't feel okay. It seemed like the pilots weren't paying attention to what was going on. It didn't seem right. Alaska Airlines said he did not have a history of medical issues. Throughout his career, he has completed his mandated FAA medical certifications in accordance with regulatory requirements. Passengers on the plane said a flight attendant told them he suffered a mental breakdown. Flight attendant got back on the speaker after he was escorted off the plane and said he had a mental breakdown. We needed to get him off the plane immediately. According to the FAA, he was flying an aircraft ERJ-175. He did not have certification to fly that. They do not believe it was incident of terrorism or ideologically motivated violence. Like I said, I just flew Alaska Airlines. See you, Holger. Holger had to run. He's got to go grab some grub, he said. Mind-blowing. It could have been me on that flight. Or I shouldn't say could have been me. I could have been on that flight. It's like, I don't know. Moving on, we finally have a Speaker of the House. Louisiana Representative, Republican Representative Mike Johnson was elected along strict party line votes, with each and every Democrat voting for honorary squad member Hakeem Jeffries. Those Dems, boy, always willing to reach across the aisle. Remember they were talking about that, reaching across the aisle to remove McCarthy? That's not reaching across the aisle. Johnson takes the gavel after 8 Republicans worked with the Democrats to oust California's Kevin McCarthy. Then we had Steve Scalise withdraw. We failed to elect Jim Jordan. Then we had Tom Chief Rhino Emmer withdraw. He was, what, I guess, late Monday and then yesterday withdrew. Finally settled on Mike Johnson, as T. Bodie messaged our group, story that appeared in the Gateway Pundit. Dems claimed that they would vote on merit. Remember that? They said they would vote on merit. Then they, of course, stuck to the party line with every one of them voting for Hakeem Jeffries. Good. Now we have a speaker. We can vote to send more money to Ukraine. Thank God. I'm not sure that makes me feel any better in a sense. 50 Cent. Rapper 50 Cent has been ripping Dopey Joe for his Delaware beach trip that went on the other day. He said, quote, "We got some real shit going on." He sent social media ablaze with a post blasting President Biden for taking another beach vacation in Delaware as chaos continued to unfold between Israel and Hamas. He says, "Hey, Joe, get the F up. We're in trouble, man." Posted that on Instagram. Then he said, Biden, it was from an article, Biden hits the beach with Middle East Congress in chaos. In a follow-up, they said, 50 Cent flames Biden. He wrote, "We got some real shit going on out here, Joe. What's the plan to get a tan and come and chill? Come on now." Conservatives, of course, jumped all over and said, you know, they turned him into an honorary conservative, but he did double down on it. And yeah, they have a picture of Dopey Joe sleeping, nodding off on the beach. Yeah, I'm not sure that 50 Cent, I don't know his political leanings. White House Deputy Spokesperson Andrew Bates pushed back, saying, "As has been the case for the better part of a century, presidents can execute the full range of their duties from anywhere in the world, whether it's a war zone in Israel or 100 miles from the White House. He works long hours every day." He spoke with several world leaders about his support for Israel's right to defend itself and push for aid to innocent Palestinians. What? Spoke to Netanyahu, Justin Trudeau, why? French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. And he delivered more security assistance to Israel, a second shipment of aid to Palestinian civilians. There are no such thing as Palestinians. And made progress toward passage of his supplemental to protect our national security, increase border funding, and grow our economy. James at his beach house in Delaware. Somebody posted, "While Americans are still being held hostage by Hamas terrorists, Joe Biden is at the beach." Yeah, well, are we shocked? Bernie Sanders back in the news. Yeah, just funneling money. Hey, the Alaskans in the chat room. Had been a while. How's it going, Alaskan? Boyd, good to see you. Haven't seen you for a while. Good to see you. Bernie Sanders funnels $70,000 to $5,000 more from his campaign coffers to his wife and to his stepson's nonprofit. It's 100 large, $200,000 that he sent. When did he send that? Transferred $75,000 to his wife's and stepson's nonprofit during the third quarter. Went to the Sanders Institute on August 8th. According to the cash follows the $200,000 that the committee sent to the nonprofit earlier this year. The institute was established by his wife, Jane, and stepson, David Driscoll, 6 years ago as a think tank to evaluate progressive mouthpieces. What the hell? However, the group has appeared to perform very little work while paying Driscoll six figures worth of compensation. Oh, what else is new? I don't know how they get away with this. I really don't. I sort of have detailed before that I have been involved with nonprofits on multiple levels. Sat on the board, was president of a Kiwanis Club here in Orlando. I was on the foundation board. I was actually the founding member of our outreach committee, which makes grants. Long story short, we came into a bunch of money through an eminent domain seizure 20 years ago, roughly. And I was the founding chairman of the outreach committee, which assessed, entertained, and assessed grant worthiness of grant requests. I don't know, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that can happen if you make grants that are not kosher, so to speak. In other words, 501c3s that aren't compliant. As an example, 501c3s, which are just run by all members of the same family, that don't have audited financial statements or statements of material, you know, no statements of no material weakness from a CPA, an actual CPA. If you're a private foundation, for example, and you give money to an individual, that can be disqualified. You can lose that tax-exempt item. And there's all kinds of stuff that can happen. It amazes me that this happens and nobody's making any waves about it. Not the IRS, but not you know, any kind of nonprofit monitoring agencies. You know, there are all kinds of watchdogs that do, you know, Charity Navigator and websites like that. Nobody's making any, you know, it's come up. It's on Fox News of all places. My God, a campaign. A political campaign account making donations to a nonprofit that's connected with the candidate and or office holder. And it's the second one. I mean, they made one earlier in the year and they've made another one. And here's the thing. You've got to show as a nonprofit where that money's going. It's not enough to say, we do good. You've got to show it. You've got to file financial statements. When you're soliciting money from the public, especially, I mean, it's inconceivable to me that this could happen and that he's not answering questions on the floor of the Senate, that he doesn't have IRS agents in his office or his campaign office, if you will, and at the offices of the nonprofit. It's unbelievable. If I had a private foundation, political or not, if I had a foundation and I was also a political office holder and I was giving money to that foundation from my campaign, it's mind-boggling. How is this guy? It's ridiculous. It really is. A member of Dopey Joe's State Department has quit. This actually might be a moment of integrity, believe it or not. I know this is going to sound hideous for me to say that, but it really is in a sense. He cited President Biden's announcement of material support for Israel, said he cannot work as the U.S. helps Israel in its war against the Hamas terrorist group. Josh Paul was his name. He worked for the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs. He was responsible for transferring arms to key American allies. He posted his resignation on social media. In it, he said, continued lethal assistance to Israel prompted his decision to leave. He said, today I informed my colleagues that I have resigned from the State Department due to a policy disagreement concerning our continual lethal assistance to Israel. That I cannot work in support of a set of major policy decisions, including rushing more arms to one side of the conflict, that I believe to be short-sighted, destructive, unjust, and contradictory to the very values that we publicly. I hate to say it, that's actually some integrity. I mean, he may be an anti-Semitic piece of crap. Now, he did condemn Hamas's attack, but said Israel's response in seeking to eliminate Hamas was too far. He says, let me be clear. Hamas's attack on Israel was not just a monstrosity. It was a monstrosity of monstrosities. I also believe that potential escalations by Iran-linked groups such as Hezbollah or by Iran itself would be a further cynical exploitation of the existing tragedy. But I believe to the core of my soul that the response Israel is taking, and with it the American support both for that response and for the status quo of the occupation, what occupation, will only lead to more and deeper suffering for both the Israeli and Palestinian people, and is not in the long-term American interest. I happen to think he's full of shit. At least he's showing some integrity that, you know, at least he's saying I'm an anti-Semite at heart, and so I won't work with somebody who doesn't go along with me on that. He says, when I came to the Bureau, the U.S. government entity most responsible for the transfer and provision of arms to partners and allies, I knew it was not without its moral complexity and moral compromises. And I made myself a promise that I would stay for as long as I felt the harm I might do would be outweighed by the good I could do. In my 11 years, I have made more moral compromises than I can recall, each heavily, but each with my promise to myself in mind and intact. I am leaving today because I believe that in our current course with regards to the continued, indeed expanded and expedited provision of lethal arms to Israel, I have reached the end of that bargain. Weird. It says, we cannot be both against occupation and for it. We cannot be both for freedom and against it. We cannot be for a better world while contributing to one that is materially worse. That's where he's full of crap. But he says the administration and much of Congress is an impulsive, the response is an impulsive reaction built on confirmation bias, political convenience, intellectual bankruptcy, and bureaucratic inertia. That is to say, it is immensely disappointing and entirely unsurprising. Decades of the same approach have shown that security for peace leads to neither security nor peace. Really? He says the U.S. should not take a side in the conflict. Wrong. We have treaties with Israel. More than that, we voted to confirm Israel as a sovereign nation in 1948. Paul's worked with the State Department since April of 2012, so guess who was president when he started working for the State Department? That's correct, Barack Hussein Obama. But I still, I shouldn't say integrity, but it's given the La Dopey Nostra, I guess it's going to pass for integrity. We can call it that. He's saying I can't, you know, I there's a limit to my tolerance as an anti-Semite. Because there's no other way to couch it. I'm sorry. He's not. He's clearly not in his right mind when he says the U.S. should stay neutral. It's not, it's ludicrous. U.S. can't be neutral. DOJ prosecutors are going to answer questions on Hunter Biden's probe behind closed doors at a House Judiciary meeting. So federal prosecutors will appear for transcribed interviews behind closed doors at the House Judiciary Committee this week amid the investigation into alleged politicization. Attorney for the Central District of California, Martin Estrada, will sit for an interview, and DOJ Tax Division attorney Stuart Goldberg is expected to sit for an interview. Yesterday and today were those respective days. Those requests came, of course, after allegations of politicization and misconduct at the Justice Department agencies throughout the years-long probe into Hunter Biden. Jim Jordan has been negotiating with the Justice Department to have federal prosecutors involved in the Biden investigation to testify before his committee for months. Special Counsel David Weiss, who is overseeing the government's investigation, is now expected to appear behind closed doors on November 7th. Justice Department initially offered Weiss for public testimony back in July, but a Justice Department official told Fox News they said he would prefer he testify in public. Merrick Garland, evidently was the one who, well, of course he was. He was the one who tapped Weiss. He's a U.S. attorney for Delaware. Been leading in the investigation since 2018. Yeah. So he charged Hunter with making a false statement in the purchase of a firearm, making a false statement really to information required to be kept by a firearm dealer, one count of possession of a firearm by a person who is an unlawful user of or addicted to a controlled substance. Pleaded not guilty to all of them. Said the investigation is ongoing. Status of the impeachment inquiry against President Biden is unclear. Supposedly, one thing Mike Johnson has said is that all the January 6th tapes are going to be released. I will believe that when and only when I see it. Just saying. Going to take a break. We're going to go back, and we are going to talk college football and the debacle that was the call against, or I should say against, but call that nullified the punt return, the incredible punt return touchdown by Cooper DeGene last week. 2.5 minutes, folks. And we are back on Hank Jones Poly Sports. I am Hank Jones, your host, for every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. We talk politics and sports. Number to call in is 319-527-6706. I have said I will take phone calls today, but if you are never called the show, if I don't recognize your number, come into the chat room, please, and tell me what area code you'd be calling from. Again, that number is 319-527-6706. Hawkeye Mike is hanging out there right now listening in. So, college football over the weekend. North Carolina took their first loss. In that game, very interesting, there was a punt return. The returner was waving off his teammates. He then grabbed the ball and returned it for several yards. Nothing was called. It was not reviewed. Nothing happened. Ball wasn't returned to the spot where he grabbed it. Wasn't returned to the spot where it landed. There was nothing that said anything about waving off his teammates, because people, punt returners, do it all the time. More on that later, of course. USC took their second loss, losing to Utah, who seems to have their number in recent years. Fans noted that reigning Heisman winner, a USC quarterback, Caleb Williams, seemed rather disinterested about the whole thing. His expression, as seen in several photos, was kind of just muted, not really, I don't know. Ohio State beat Penn State 20-12. I really thought Penn State had a shot. I thought this was the year, but Ohio State's defense is obviously better. The offense did just enough. In the end, USC's defense had no answer for Marvin Harrison Jr. That's pretty much the main thing. This week, the Hawkeyes are off, so I don't really care what happens in the other games. I do know Wisconsin took down Illinois. Illinois was leading most of that game, and then Wisconsin, with, I believe, 37 seconds left, came back and won 25-21. So with the Hawkeyes lost, the Hawkeyes are now back in second place in the Big Ten West. Now, Wisconsin is going to lose at Ohio State. There's no guarantee the Hawkeyes have anything going on. There are a couple good games this week. Oregon goes to Utah, number 8 versus number 13. Oklahoma goes to Kansas, who is a little bit better than they were last year. Indiana to Penn State, that's not a big one. Georgia, Florida's this weekend, the world's largest outdoor cocktail party, they call it, in Jacksonville, Florida. I think Georgia's just a better team, but people are talking about, well, Gators are showing some life. Duke at Louisville, that's an interesting game, somewhat of an interesting game. Washington at Stanford, not big. USC at Cal, not big. But Air Force, still unbeaten, heads to Colorado State. Tennessee and Kentucky will be a decent game. Ohio State is at Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I thought it was Columbus. So Ohio State travels to Wisconsin. Wisconsin's not going to win that. So the Hawkeyes will be back in the driver's seat in a sense, but they've got to win. North Carolina goes to Georgia Tech. They, like I said, they took their first loss last week to Virginia of all teams. And interestingly enough, there was a punt return where the player waved off his teammates on a punt return, and nothing was called. No review, no nothing. The reason we bring that up, of course, the Hawkeye game last Saturday. Basically what happened, Hawkeyes were behind. Minnesota punted. The returner, Cooper DeJean, who's already returned one punt for a touchdown, is, you know, he's all everything. The ball bounced. He waved off his teammates. He went and grabbed it and avoided a couple Minnesota tacklers at the beginning, got out of it, cut across field, and scored a touchdown. Crowd was going wild. So was I. And they said it was under review. Well, I kind of assumed it would be under review for whether he went out of bounds, because you were looking and it's, oh, he could have. But that became obvious he hadn't. But they kept watching. So apparently what they then said was that he made an invalid fair catch signal. Now, I've talked to several people, a former official who lives here in Orlando. I've seen stuff from other officials. They've said, one, it was a terrible call. There's no way you can interpret that as a fair catch signal or an invalid fair catch. And yes, you are allowed to wave off teammates, despite PJ Fleck saying you can't, that the ball's dead. It's not giving up the ball. Pat McAfee, multiple times. He actually had Aaron Rodgers on, who also said it was the worst call they've seen in a long time. Don Patterson, former Hawkeye offensive coordinator, and Corey Breda, who hosts a podcast called Hawkeye of the Storm, they talked at length about it last week. Now, there are other issues, but look, nobody on the field or in the stadium saw it that way. It's clear, despite revisionist attempts, by the way, it is not reviewable. The part cited as being reviewable is only because it was a scoring play. However, stoppage of play is not reviewable. And on the other side, non-stoppage of play is not reviewable. And what I mean is this, had an official blown the whistle, blown it dead, cannot go back and replay it. They cannot say he would have scored none of that. If they had, when they blow an inadvertent whistle and stop play, that is not reviewable. Not stopping the play is also not reviewable. What is reviewable is whether he was in bounds or not. If there were a targeting call, but there was not in this case. They're not reviewable because they're not reversible. You can't restart a play. You can't go back to the moment when a play was stopped or not stopped. You just can't. What was reviewable in that circumstance was whether or not he remained in bounds, which he did. A face mask that might have occurred, a clip, a block in the back, etc., would not have been reviewable. The fact no official stopped play or signaled the quote-unquote invalid fair catch made it a non-issue. Now, look, P.J. Fleck is saying so. He looks more like a moron and an idiot than he does a coach who finally beat Iowa. First, he was seen standing on the field, I guess, after everyone had left, just gazing at the field. But for him to say it was a correct call was ludicrous. For him to cite a rule that signaling or yelling gives up the ball is incorrect, unless it is actually called. But it wasn't called. Why? Because nobody interpreted that play as a fair catch of any kind. Just for the folks out there who insist on saying it was a signal, how often do you see guys call for a fair catch on a ball bouncing 10 or 20 feet away and then rush to the ball, knowing that inadvertently touching it makes it a live ball? None. No one. Nada. They didn't deserve to. That's not the point. A lot of times teams don't deserve to win, but they do. Iowa has had those kinds of wins before where we didn't deserve to win, but they have. In this case, the officials directly affected the outcome of the game. Now, some say, we let that play out because you just never know. Well, no, you don't. You don't. You know why? Because they officials are literally told to err on the side of caution and stop play in questionable moments for the sake of player safety. By letting it, quote-unquote, play out, players were actually at risk of injury, especially those who thought play was stopped. Except, of course, everyone in that stadium knew it was a legit punt return touchdown, P.J. Fleck included. Even Kirk Ferentz was told that the review was to make sure that Cooper DeJean was in bounds. No mention was made of any invalid fair catch signal, because there wasn't one, first of all. Second of all, because everyone knew it wasn't. So now let's get to the problems that we have with the Hawkeye offense. Brother Tommy and I have discussed this several times over the years, actually talked about it back in the early Kirk Ferentz years. The Hawkeyes, when successful early, and it's usually using presumably scripted plays, they have lost games, not just once or twice, but several times, because they make no adjustments after that initial scripting. Conversely, they have often succeeded when they give up early leads because of the very adjustments they have made. I can cite tons of examples, but some that come to mind. On the losing end, Minnesota 2014, now they got crunched, but they started out doing well. They scored early, and then they didn't know what to do after the script. Maryland in 2014. Northwestern in 2009, yes, that was the Ricky Stanzi got injured game, but they scored early, and they just lost momentum. It's like they didn't know how to go off script. Purdue in 2017. Purdue in 2020, for that matter. Purdue in 2017, where they had the lead and then they gave up some touchdowns and just didn't know how to recover and stay on script or whatever they needed to do. Iowa State in 2002, believe it or not, and 2022. Minnesota this year. On the winning side, Michigan State in 2002, where Michigan State got a lead and somehow the Hawks just turned it around. Minnesota in 2016, they adjusted. They made adjustments. Wisconsin in 2009, Penn State in 2009, Iowa State in 2015. Michigan, two different times, 2013 and 2016. What I mean is the Hawks figured out a way to come back, made adjustments, and benefited from it. Whereas other times they either made bad adjustments or didn't make adjustments and lost. It's happened where they lose. Usually they abandon one or the other. They'll abandon the run or they'll abandon the pass. But they've also won after exploiting the run and sometimes the pass. Look, even the brilliantly schemed win over Ohio State in 2017 was a departure from the usual pattern of having to pass on third down after minimal or no yardage rushes. They were passing on first and second down. That game, the Hawkeyes, by the way, with Brian Ferentz as an offensive coordinator, mixed the pass and run beautifully, and they constantly kept Ohio State's defense off balance. Now, look, the defense is stellar, as usual. In addition to Cooper DeJean and Sebastian Castro in the back four, they also have a line that is solid against the run, gets decent pressure against the pass, although not always generating sacks. But they have some depth. The NCAA would get off its ass and allow Noah Shannon back on the field. It's only going to get stronger, not to mention deeper. But what about, okay, the linebacker crew of Jay Higgins, Nick Jackson, Kyler Fisher, etc.? Jay Higgins leads the nation. Literally, the whole NCAA FBS in tackles. He has 105. The next closest, 81. It's 105 tackles in 8 games. That's 13-plus tackles a game. That is insane. Now, his dad, Roy, pointed out that he had 471 in his high school career. It's not like he was playing behind inferior linebackers, by the way. Jack Campbell, Seth Benson, even Justin Jacobs, who, by the way, hasn't done much, if anything, at his quote-unquote dream school, Oregon. Justin Jacobs was great when he was healthy, and he would have added some depth. But I'm pretty sure he's no Jay Higgins. He won't have the kind of NFL career that Jay Higgins has, probably Nick Jackson will have. Look, I'm bragging a bit because even last year I said Jay Higgins is going to be a star. I was right. But you could see it when he was on the field in his less involved role. He's fantastic against the run. He's good in coverage, too, but he just has a nose for where the ball is, and he hits like a truck. He's just very field-aware. And that's partly coaching. It's partly talent. I mean, the defense is just stellar. The punting game, the kicking game, the return games are all really good to great. Torrey Taylor was his usual self, stellar, last Saturday. Drew Stevens was solid. Cooper DeJean, of course, showed why P.J. Fleck has to lie and pretend he knew it was an invalid fair catch signal all along. Never mind that nobody on the Minnesota sideline was signaling it. His players knew it wasn't. The one official who made that insane assertion that they let these play out, which is beyond astounding in its incompetence. But anyway, forgetting all that, the rest of the units were solid. So back to the offense. There are several problems, of course. Now, one, depth has taken a hit. Tight end one, tight end two, QB one are all out for the season. Tight end three has missed games. QB three hasn't actually been available the whole season. The offensive line has missed some games with injuries. The running back one and two have missed time. Caleb Johnson and Jizzet backs have had injuries as well. It does add up. It does add up. But injuries are a part of the game. Yeah, Hawkeye Mike made the point. Even Aaron Rodgers on that Pat McAfee show said it was revolting. The offensive line has been inconsistent. Yes, it's better than last year, but it is still inconsistent. Yes, Minnesota successfully loaded the box. And quarterback Deacon Hill experienced too much pressure. Okay, fine. Look, the wide receivers have drop issues. Last Saturday, we had one where they said the sun got in his eyes. I mean, God, what next? Okay, maybe it's a familiarity issue. But let's not forget, Deacon Hill took most of the snaps during training camp this summer because Cade McNamara had that quad injury. Look, Deacon Hill simply isn't mobile. Compared to an injured Cade McNamara, maybe. But he showed no possibility of evading the rush in his appearances thus far. Ironically, he had the longest run from scrimmage last Saturday for the Hawkeyes. 7 yards on a broken play. So, yeah, while Minnesota loaded the box, Deacon Hill and the receivers, whether it's the wide receivers or tight ends, they should have had some success. And by the way, Kirk and Brian, using the running backs in the passing game is still legal, last I checked. Scheme and execution first. Scheme isn't really the problem. I know people try to say it is and going to a spread. If you could really picture the Iowa Hawkeyes trying to run a spread, it's not going to happen. It's multiple things. It's play calling. It's execution. It's recruiting. It's personnel. It's being willing to expand the playbook, expand the repertoire, utilize more of the playbook, whatever. I mean, Deacon Hill, as Mike just messaged, Deacon Hill's completing basically 33% of his passes. I'm sorry, any way you look at that, that's unacceptable. So, yes, it's scheme. The scheme itself isn't the problem. It's the play calling. It's the unwillingness to expand the playbook. It's like they, you know, look, I'm not expecting the jet sweep. We've run the white guy jet sweep enough times. But, you know, the first game of the year, the second or third offensive play, might have been the second drive, but Cade McNamara executed a beautiful play-action fake, and Seth Anderson was wide open down the field. Almost looked like he was going to drop the touchdown, by the way. Don't have to establish the run to establish the play-action. If teams are loading the box, the play action will work then. That's when it will work. But it starts at the top. Look, nobody loves Kirk Ferentz more than me. I think he's a great guy. I think he's a great coach, and he has done, historically speaking, more with less than most coaches over his 25-year career at Iowa. As I said earlier, Felicia Goodson talked about, he's not a racist. He's a great guy, a great man. He makes his ball team feel like family. But what is happening falls at the feet of the offense. He has to decide if he wants to either A, give Brian Ferentz full reign, or if Brian Ferentz is getting full reign, whether he needs the help, more help, needs to be replaced, whatever. I mean, let's look at it by position group. The offensive line catching some slack. But, you know, I think he has done okay. There's been some improvement in the offensive line. So give him some, you know, give him some, not a pass, but, you know, the tight end group, obviously. You know, even the ones that have, you know, Addison Ostrenga had a miscue where he went out of bounds and then came back in and was the first to touch the ball. But he also had a great catch that I was surprised held up under review, by the way. But he had a great catch to keep a drive alive. But the offensive line itself, it needs work. The tight ends, you know, as they get more involved as the ones that are here now, you're going to see continued improvement because I think the tight ends are coached well. We have good ones. Wide receivers, man. Kelton Copeland is the wide receivers coach. He certainly doesn't get a pass here. Sorry, he doesn't. I mean, people have asked, you know, when's the last time you saw a Hawkeye receiver catch a pass in stride and not get hit right away by the defense? I mean, there was that play, Seth Anderson. That was the play to Eric All against Purdue, although that's a tight end, but you know, can't give Kelton Copeland a pass at this point. I mean, maybe they block well downfield, but again, are they not getting separation? Is it their hands? It's multiple things. The running backs, I think Liddell Betts has done a great job thus far. He was a great running back when he played at Iowa. He was a very good running back in the pros. You know, they've had some injuries, but our running backs have usually performed reasonably well over the years. Now, I think Liddell was not quite there yet, but, you know, Tyler Goodson gained 1,000 yards just two seasons ago. He was first team All Big Ten in 2020. I mean, our running backs have not been a problem. Are there some that are not as good as others? Sure. But, you know, there have been games where Caleb Johnson is the guy, and you go with him. He's what's needed. Other games where it's been LeSean Williams. Now, last weekend, they kept going to LeSean Williams. Caleb Johnson did not get many carries. Jazzy and Patterson, I guess, was available, but was not used in the much as in the play calling backs. Are they the best? No. Well, we've got good running backs. And frankly, it's incumbent upon the play calling to give them room. And one, if the D is loading the box, you've got to make them pay. And how it is that our receivers aren't making them pay, or that we're relying too much on our tight ends to make them pay, either way, it's unacceptable to the performance of the offense. I don't get why they're not using the receivers, either in the slot or out of the backfield. Well, you know, why not? You know, too often we're using wide or tight ends in the slot or as H-backs or whatever. Why not LeSean Williams or Jazz Patterson in the slot with Caleb Johnson as the deep back, or vice versa, whatever. I mean, Caleb Johnson showed he can catch passes. He had that catch against Purdue. So, yeah, obviously, why not get the running backs more involved in the pass game? Use them peripherally. If we cannot take the top off the defense vertically, then we're going to have to utilize a horizontal passing game to some degree. When that succeeds, then they will have to respect the box, and then you should be able to get wide receivers open. It appears they have no hot route for receivers. I know they do, but it doesn't look like they do. Now, is Deacon Hill locking on to one receiver? And I think he's going through progressions, maybe not as well as Cade does or as well as previous quarterbacks have done, but certainly seems capable enough. There are certainly plays you can see that he's gone to who was not the primary receiver. But let's get to quarterbacks. Brian Ferentz, as a quarterback's coach, you know, it's oftentimes the offensive coordinator is also the quarterback's coach. Ken O'Keefe, back when he was the offensive coordinator, he then became our quarterback coach for a while. He retired. Replacing with Brian Ferentz, I don't get that. I just don't get that. Now, a guy doesn't have to have played quarterback to be a good quarterback's coach. But Brian Ferentz, I'm sorry, as a lineman, he's just not a quarterback's coach. Nothing historically points to that. Stubbornness on the part of Kirk Ferentz. Now, maybe he just couldn't get somebody hired right away. I know that John Budmeyer is being used as a consultant, but he's probably the quarterback coach. But he's not there on the sidelines as a consultant. Something's got to give there. Look, I'm not mad at Deacon Hill. I feel sorry for him. He's being thrown in. But, you know, people talk about, well, our quarterbacks have to learn the system. Well, Joey Labus has been there 3 years. Now, some people have said Joey Labus has some issues, that he might be in the doghouse. I also know that he was not available until the Michigan State game, which ironically is the game in which Cade McNamara got hurt. But Joey Labus played in our bowl game last year. He did a creditable job, especially in never having played before. His first extensive action is in a bowl game that he has to get his first start as well. Mike makes the point, why is it that our short passes are thrown into triple coverage? It seems like all our passes. I don't get that. And if we have that kind of coverage, it means somebody's open. I mean, a team cannot stack the box and then have triple coverage on a guy without somebody being open. Look, I'm not mad at Deacon Hill. I don't want to cut him down at all. He's doing the best he can in a situation that he probably didn't expect to be playing. I think he was brought in as insurance. give Joey Labus a shot. I mean, a lot of people say Joey Labus won't be here next year. I think if he gets a shot here, you know, for him to leave would be kind of like, why? But would Deacon leave? Well, and now they're pretty much saying, you know, you get one free transfer. Guys that are transferring a second time are getting shot down on immediate eligibility, except in, you know, very specific cases for very specific reasons, family, health, et cetera. So Joey Labus could go, but Deacon Hill, if he leaves, he's going to have to sit a year. I mean, it's over for him at that point. Marco Lanes, a freshman. Now, at most, he's only going to play four games now. So why not give him a shot? He won't be taken off the redshirt. He is a true freshman. Letting him play does not endanger his redshirt status. So why not give Joey Labus a shot? You know, there was a time back in 2007, this is documented, that Arvell Nelson out of Glenville, Ohio, was given the keys before, I believe, the Northwestern game, or in favor of Jake Christensen, who was the starter, inherited the starter's role after Drew Tate finished his career at Iowa. Supposedly, he just screwed up. He was late for team meetings, was late for the bus, I guess, to take him to the air. I mean, whatever it was. I mean, he missed something. I mean, he was literally given the keys and he blew it. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always a danger, of course. But why not just tell Joey Labus right now, you're the guy. You're the number one guy right now. Now, you know, there might be a reason they don't tell us that. There's no reason that they have to. Maybe, you know, give him the number one reps. Tell Marco Lanes to be ready on the sideline. Tell Deacon Hill that, look, we appreciate you, but we still need, you know, results. Now, I get it. The kind of guy Kirk Ferentz is, he probably doesn't want to say that it's all on the quarterback. That's the most visible. I used to think, I'm not sure, but Spencer Petras was proof of that. Look, Spencer Petras is, I'm sure, a really nice guy and a good teammate, and he's around right now as a student, a grad assistant or whatever. But he was not a liability, but he was not an asset. He was not getting the job done. Now, look, he had a decent 2020. A decent record as a starter in 2021. Simply, he wasn't getting it done. And Deacon Hill's not getting it done. You know, typically somebody that fumbles twice in a game, a running back or a receiver, is going to get the bench. It's going to get the doghouse. Deacon Hill has fumbled twice. Now, granted, he wasn't protected well. My God, he needs to protect the ball better. The interception was just stupid, mainly because he threw it across the field. It was tailor-made to be picked off. Frankly, Kirk Ferentz is right when he said, you know, even after they nullified the punt return, we had the ball. We had a minute and a half. You know, I mean... It looked like the whole thing was designed, you know, did they not have any alternate plays? I mean, if they were at that point not stacking the box, presumably they weren't because they were playing more of a prevent defense coverage on the receivers, why not then utilize the run game a little bit? We still had a timeout. Utilize the run game for a few plays. Utilize play action. You get a run play that works, and play action on the next play is going to be more likely to succeed. Kirk Ferentz has to decide at this point. Has to decide. Are you going to ride this horse? Because if he does, he is tarnishing his legacy. No ifs, ands, or buts about that. He is tarnishing his legacy. I think if Brian Ferentz is gone, I think Kirk will retire. I don't think Kirk will stay around if Brian's gone. And I get that. Some people will say, oh, he's just being, no. Works with him. I worked with my father for 20 years. Never the same after my father died in my office. It was never the same after that. So it wouldn't be the same for Kirk either. I get that. But they need to have, the whole staff needs to have a come to Jesus meeting. I mean, Brian needs to kick some asses. Now, much like his father, he's not blaming assistant coaches. He's saying we've got to do what we do and do it better. That's admirable. He's not throwing any players under the bus. He's not throwing any assistant coaches under the bus. A lot of other coaches do that on a routine basis. It's like Jim Harbaugh, who, by the way, is part of a program in Michigan that's being investigated. I'll talk about that in a bit. But they've got to have a come to Jesus meeting. They've got to say, look, obviously this is not working. And there's no reason we couldn't have moved Minnesota all over the field. They're stacking the box. And they're getting to our quarterback when we're dropping back. So don't drop back. Move him around. And if he's too slow to move around, then get a quarterback that you can move him around. I've seen stuff on forums that, you know, the backup Joey Levis might be in the doghouse. I don't know that. I have no way of knowing that. I don't care. But if he is, then the next guy up has got to be who they go to. If that means going to QB4, i.e. Marco Lanes, then do it. By all accounts, he was lighting it on fire when he was recruited. So get him involved. But what's happening now? Can't continue. There are four games left against Northwestern, Rutgers, Illinois, and Nebraska. Now, if they were to win out, and assuming Wisconsin loses to Ohio State, at 10-2, Iowa is in the Big Ten Championship. They play Michigan, who appears to be, you know, on their way there. They're playing a team that's right now accused of cheating, accused of sending someone to other schools, to other stadiums to scout future opponents. That is against NCAA rules. It is against those rules because some teams can afford to do that. Smaller schools can't. People say it's to learn their signs and stealing. It's not that. It's to learn routine. And if you're doing it and other schools aren't and it's against the rules, you are getting an advantage. So they'd be playing probably a Michigan team. Jim Harbaugh has shown we'll stop at nothing. So that's an uphill battle, but it's better to have that uphill battle than no battle at all. But assuming if I were to win out, presumably they will be the Big Ten West representative in the Big Ten Championship game. And presumably, we saw what happened against Penn State. Well, what happened against Minnesota is just as much an indicator that this team is not in any good position to win a Big Ten title currently. Can it change? Maybe. I don't know. As I said earlier, there are a lot of injuries. You're missing some guys. That's tough. But damn it, get there and make the most of it. Give it the best shot. You can't win if you don't play. But you also can't win if you don't sometimes take shots. Make changes. If you think urging Deacon Hill to do better, look, he's got three games as a starter plus a game in relief. And has shown us he is simply not performing well enough right now. Now, we've seen it in the past. The running back fumbles twice in a game, and he gets benched. Now, again, Sean Williams had that fumble against Michigan State. They got him back up on the horse, mainly because at that point, Caleb Johnson and Jazz Patterson were not available. Something's got to change. And like it or not, and I am a KF supporter, I'm a KF fan, but like it or not, the buck stops with him. The offense stops with his son, the offensive coordinator. And that stops then stops with Kirk. If Brian's not getting it done, Kirk needs to step in. If he needs to get him more help or if he needs to make a change. Either way. People say, well, what about letting Brian go back to offensive line coach? It's not like George Barnett. George Barnett hasn't done that bad. He's done great. You know, there is improvement this year over last year. It may not seem like it sometimes, but there is improvement. Despite going completely backwards last Saturday, there has been improvement. And again, firing a different assistant so that Brian can take over, sorry. That's the optics on that are terrible. You'd never be able to hire another assistant that would trust you to not do the same to him. So Kirk Ferentz has to make that decision to either step aside or admit I'm wrong. I mean, there are people that will say he's so petty. He just doesn't want to admit he made a mistake. No, Kirk Ferentz is not that way. He's a little more mature than that. He's a lot smarter than that. I think he wants to show confidence in his players. I mean, as I said, this isn't all Deacon Hill's fault. But by the same token, 33%. Completion rate, that's not good. That's unacceptable. It's not winning football. It will not lead to winning football. I know some people say if they just made the show of going downfield. Well, if you throw downfield 10 times and don't complete any of them, yeah, that's not good. That's not going to cut it. You have to have some success, but you also have to throw downfield. Everybody says, well, right now they don't have the pass protection. They've had the pass protection to throw downfield. They haven't always adjusted when other teams do certain things to try and mitigate it. Minnesota, as I said, loaded the box. But if we haven't figured out how to defeat a team that's loading the box, you know, it's time for a change at that point. Simply is. As we're winding it up, I want to say thanks to Duck, Northwest Media, the Alaskan. Hey, Joseph Gibson's in the house, candidate for North Carolina State House, District 65, and host of Restoring Our Republic. Holger was here earlier, wearing, as he said, his Goldie Gopher shirt. I know what he wanted to do. He wanted to get on, but he had to get going. But he wanted to get on and gloat. That's what he wanted to do. I would have let him. Thanks to Hawkeye Mike for listening on the phones. Wow, it's a tough time to be a Hawkeye football fan. It's a tough time right now in with what's going on in the U.S., I mean, we finally have a Speaker of the House, but as somebody said, namely me, oh, great. Now they can actually approve more aid to Ukraine. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. We shouldn't send another dime over there. What happens in Ukraine is important, but we've done enough. We've done our part. End story. Israel, it's an ongoing war, and they were attacked. And not just militarily. It was terrorism. It was an act of terrorism and an act of war. Terrible what happened. But we actually have people in our Congress basically saying Israel doesn't have the right to retaliate. There are still Americans in captivity, by the way. We have people worrying about Ukraine. What the hell? I think there's something else that's not being talked about. We're not having budgets submitted anymore. They are literally living under a continuing resolution. They are literally not drawing up budgets in the House or the Senate. Hell, the White House isn't doing it. That's got to stop. That's got to change. That's unforgivable. I mean, if a you know, has its stock traded on the open market, did that, they would rightfully be called on the carpet. Rightfully so, they would be called on the carpet. Welcome Banjo 80 to the chat room as well. No, they would be called on the carpet. Why? Because you are getting money from the public and you are not operating as a successful business because you have no budgets. You are running out of control. That's what our government's doing with money from the public. It's insane. So hopefully Mike Johnson can help restore some of this. It's not going to be his on him alone. Jim Jordan and his Judiciary Committee have a lot to do. The Appropriations Committee. Of, by the way, what's his name, Rutherford, that was ranking on Jim Jordan? He's a member of the Appropriations Committee. There are 12 things that he is supposed to be voting on every year. June, I believe it is. They didn't do it. Nobody's holding their feet to the fire. I mean, everybody's bitching at Jim Jordan and in the Judiciary Committee, but why aren't we bitching at the Appropriations Committee? So that's got to change, and it's going to take all of them. We have got to step in. It's simple as that. We have got to step in to our representatives. I mean, I would have said tonight, had we not had a speaker elected, I would have said, you need to call your representatives and tell them why are they not supporting a speaker. I send him stuff. He doesn't reply. I've sent him stuff on Twitter. He doesn't reply. But at a certain point, that's going to be made public. I mean, that's going to be echoed loud and clear that this guy's a bum. He's just there living off of us. But that's got to stop. Hopefully, with a speaker, we can start down that road. I'm not holding out much hope. Okay, so I told you earlier about the text I got from someone who's has a family member who works in TSA and the warnings that they're getting. I can't stress enough, be very careful right now, folks. Churches, I think a place you'd have to be careful, shopping malls, restaurants, schools. You know, we, in spite of the fact that we've had school shootings and stuff and tried to beef up security, schools are vulnerable. These terrorists have shown that they don't care who they kill, who they terrorize. So be really careful. Be alert. Know what's going on around you. I know it's not practical for some people to carry a firearm, so don't. But if you're not going to carry a firearm, be aware of what's going on around you. On that note, folks, I want to thank everyone for being here. As always, it's fun to sort of go over what's happening. But being vigilant doesn't, you know, I can't stress it enough. So, folks, have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. As I said, I'm probably going to do a hankerings tomorrow because I'm paddling early. It would be around 7 o'clock Eastern time. It would be for an hour. And I will put that notice out there if I'm doing it. So, in the meantime, be safe. Have fun. Live life. Don't sit around in fear of this. Be aware of it, but don't be in fear of it. Aware, not fearful. But yeah, definitely be aware. It's a great time to be outside the fall. Me and Mrs. Hank are buying apples again because we know they're really in season. I mean, we buy them other times, but it's great when they're in season. Really is. Picked up some today called Arkansas Black out of North Carolina. They're good. I like them. I've got some Pink Ladies. We've always liked those. We like Pink Ladies. We like Fuji's. But it's apple season, folks. In the meantime, have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. Be safe. God bless. Good night, folks.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.